Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. Dominic here. This is an interview episode. My guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Froude. Dr. Froude is the Associate Professor of Egyptology at Oxford University in England. On top of that, she is the Director of the Griffith Institute, Oxford's Centre of Egyptology. Needless to say, these are significant roles at the heart of Egyptological research in the UK. And Liz's work in the field and laboratory is moving in some really interesting directions. Looking at the self-presentation of non-royal people through several periods of Egyptian history, Dr. Froude brings together many strands of information to construct a more complete picture of people's lives. There are texts, of course, but also more personal traces, like graffiti, private statues, and the physical spaces where these objects or inscriptions were located. As we will see in the interview, Dr. Froude's work is uncovering fascinating insights into how ancient people wanted to depict themselves and the lengths they went to connect with their gods, their communities, and their homes. I sat down to chat with Dr. Froude via Skype. Due to time zone differences, we were recording this at 4:30 in the morning for me, which is why I sound like a half-dead zombie for the first few minutes of conversation. Fortunately, Dr. Froude's enthusiasm woke me up and we hit the ground running. Also, if both of our accents sound strange to you, that's because Dr. Froude, like me, comes from New Zealand. So I hope you're ready for a couple of Kiwi nerds back and forthing about ancient lives and ancient peoples. That's enough from me. On with the show. Allow me to introduce Dr. Elizabeth Froude, Associate Professor of Egyptology, to share her wonderful knowledge.
Good morning or good afternoon, Liz. Thank you very much for joining me on the History of Egypt podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Liz, you've written extensively on Ramessid-era persons and how their biographical texts in tombs, temples, and graffiti convey different priorities of self-representation. If you were at a cocktail party and had to summarize your work and findings to a person, how would you describe the main characteristics of Ramessid self-representation in their texts?
That's it's an interesting question, especially considering a cocktail party context. I would say, I mean, it's biography as a genre in ancient Egypt has a very long history. So people start having biographical texts inscribed on the walls of their tombs in the third millennium. And so by the time you get to my time period, to the Ramessid period, so beginning about 1200 BC, you have this extensive tradition, this ongoing central tradition of biographical writing for elites, you know, for you know, 1500 years. And so the Ramessid use of the genre is both draws on these traditions and is very much within these traditions of biographical writing, but it also has features that are quite distinctive. So when I say it's diverse, well, of course, all biographical writing from ancient Egypt is diverse, but I see a particular, I see diversity as particularly characteristic of my material, in part because in the 19th and 20th dynasties, biography is not a genre that elites are choosing to use with great regularity. So it's a more unusual genre for people to commission for their monuments. And that's quite striking. So I feel like, you know, you have this grand tradition of biographical writing up till the end of the 18th dynasty, and then it's less used, and when it is used, they're doing quite distinctive things with it. So it's that I'm interested in why people choose something that is maybe not so fashionable anymore. And for the biographies themselves, They are inscribed more usually in temple environments than in tomb context. So this is quite a shift from earlier periods where the tomb, you know, the tomb chapel where you have scenes of daily life and maybe religious texts about your transition to the next world, but you'd also have biographical texts that tell a story about you. And the tomb context was very much where these texts were set up. But for my period, it's much more in temple environments. So people are putting their biographies on the bodies of statues. And in a couple of cases, really extraordinary cases, they're putting biographies on the walls of the temple itself. So you have Karnak Temple, one of the major temple complexes in Egypt, dedicated to the state god Amun. And yet on the walls of this temple, you have inscriptions and scenes of the high priest of Amun that tell a little of their life story. And that's quite a radical change. You don't get that sort of thing in state temple complexes in quite the same way from earlier periods. So there's transformations in context, possibilities in context, and there's this kind of shift into the temple environment that's really interesting, I think.
Mm, that's a good answer. And that covers my follow-up question as well, which is good. In terms of the, just for sort of more detail, in terms of the content of their biographies, mm-hmm. do they emphasize anything different?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of a standard way of thinking about them that's sort of in the literature and has been in the literature for a while, that there's more of an emphasis on your relationship with the gods. So earlier biographies, say from the earlier 18th dynasty, really emphasize your relationship to the king and your service to the king. For example, your involvement in military expeditions and campaigns in which you defended the king or had significant military achievements in relationship to the king. You don't get anything like that, hardly ever, in the Ramesside text. I know of one Ramesside biography that talks about military achievement, and it's in the context of temple building. So this guy builds a temple in Nubia for his king, using resources that came out of a conquest in Nubia. So that's the sort of, it's again linked in with temple building. So, and what you have instead is people articulating relationships to the divine sphere. So one of my favorite texts is from a tomb context. It's quite unusual in that. It's from a Theban tomb on the West Bank, and it's inscribed over the entrance to the burial chamber. So instead of being inscribed in the front, sort of more public space of the tomb, it's inscribed over the entrance into the burial chamber. Mm. And it describes him seeing Hathor in a dream. So he has a dream. Hathor comes to him in the dream, speaks to him, tells him about the tomb space that he's going to have, sort of legitimizes his the place for his tomb. And you actually have a record of her speech, her kind of her blessing to him that's articulated in this text. And that's such an intimate relationship to a god, you know, seeing her in a dream, having her come to you, profound divine favor. And it also has this kind of real intimacy of relationship. He actually calls her by a nickname. He calls her Heli in the dream, which is sort of a nickname for her rather than, you know, oh my great goddess, which he does a little bit of, but he also has this nickname for her, and that gives this really kind of sense of being, you know, so kind of intimate with the goddess. So you get texts like this that are extraordinary in their presentation of a relationship to the divine, to gods and goddesses. Goddesses in particular, which is interesting. Maybe goddesses were more accessible. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
That is fascinating. I'll need the reference on that one because that's really cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. I'll pass it on to you.
It reminds me of that Beatles song, Let It Be.
Oh,
you can
sort
of imagine him singing about Hathor and sweet words she says.
Absolutely. Actually, there's another biography from Deir al-Medina. And again, it talks about seeing her in a dream. but it's more in a party context. So he seems to be, you know, in a festival, maybe getting a bit drunk, and he passes out, and then he has this dream of Hathor. And in that case, you know, it's, the text is quite broken, so it's hard to know exactly what the divine blessing is. And in the other guy's case, it's I think it relates directly to his acquisition of the tomb space. But in the guy from Deir al-Medina, you know, the community that built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, his text is just more joyous. It's more just sort of generally that she imparts this sort of joyous blessing upon him, maybe because he's been celebrating her festival and probably getting a bit drunk. So that's a really
maybe there was something in the beer.
Definitely something in the beer.
Now, at the time that we're recording this, the podcast is exploring the Amarna period and everything that involves, totally ignoring Akhenaten and Nefertiti and all those people who hog the limelight. What can you tell us about non-royal biographies of Amarna and its immediate aftermath? Do they have any characteristics that are distinctive from the earlier 18th dynasty?
Yes. And I think, again, it's unsurprising in the context. It's extreme loyalism to the king. So it's often said, although it's more complicated than this, but you can say that Akhenaten positions himself as a kind of, as the primary mediator with the divine world and the only way of accessing the divine world. So his position is kind of sharpened and centralized within elite culture. And so the members of his court that are having biographies inscribed in their tombs, and it's, in this case, as far as we know, only in tomb spaces at the site of Amarna, what they focus on in their biographies is that relationship to the king. And it fits very much, if you think where the, you know, the biographies are inscribed in the front room of the tomb, again, the more public space of the tomb, and the representations in that space, so the pictures in that space are often of the king in his chariot or the king imparting rewards upon the individual. So the king is so visually prominent in those tomb spaces that the biographies are sort of part of that overall representation of royal power and royal benevolence. And so I think you just have this this much more intense focus on the relationship with the king, this intense loyalism. But in context, it makes sense, and it's in keeping with the overall design of these tomb spaces.
Of course. Following on from that, do the biographies of Amarna have any observable influences on those of the following generations and the 19th dynasty?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think you can see an influence in the sort of immediate post-Amarna period. And I think the texts that are most fun to kind of examine that process through are the ones belonging to Horemheb. So Horemheb, of course, becomes king and is sort of the founder of the 19th dynasty, although he's often...
Spoilers.
Sorry. sorry, everyone, don't listen. So because of his position as this non-royal person who then becomes royal, his biographical texts are really interesting. So he has two scribe statues. Statues that show him seated, cross-legged, in the scribal pose. I think one of them has a scribal palette on his lap and maybe the scribal, you know, hieroglyph over his shoulder. At least one of them has that, the one in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And the texts on that are, again, very loyalist. So they show that that Amarna theme of loyalism to the king, but they also position him very much as the second in charge. So he's compared to Thoth, the god Thoth. The god Thoth is often positioned as the deputy to the sun god, and having a sort of vizieral role as a god. And so Horemheb in these texts relates himself very much to Thoth and stresses his Thoth-like ability. So he's sort of, you can see him sort of positioning himself in relationship to the king. So there's still this theme of loyalism, but it is sort of using the divine sphere or using divine models and paradigms to explore that loyalism. So you can see a hint of what is to come in biography, but you can also see something of the Amarna influence, or quite a lot of the Amarna influence in these texts. And then there's a statue in Turin, where in the Turin Museum, showing him as king, and yet it has a biography inscribed on the back, semi-biography of his coronation, and it tells of his non-royal life going into his kind of transformation as king. So you have this extraordinary kind of set of material showing this transition from royal to non-royal, and this kind of use of biography to negotiate that, and the use of biography as a genre to negotiate that. So I find his material very interesting for exploring the immediate transformations of biography as a genre from the Amarna period to the post-Amarna. And I'd love to do some more work on his material at some point. It's on my list of things to do. And then as you move into the Ramesid period, I wonder if part of the response, or part of the reason why biography is not such a common genre, is because of a bit of a reaction to its prominence in the Amarna court. And so you have a kind of a movement away from biography because maybe it was such a strong genre in the Amarna period that it's sort of rejected a little bit in the post-Amarna period. Or maybe it's just a fashion thing, or changes in context and people's focuses sort of shift and change, and maybe it's less directly related to Amarna. But I'm sure Amarna is part of these transformations and an elite display, and a kind of stimulating these elite these transformations. But of course, you can see the Amarna influence in the language. So you have the later phase of the language of Egyptian called Late Egyptian, which comes into the sort of documentary sphere. So documentary texts start to get written in this new form of the Egyptian language. And this influences the monumental texts. So we see that very strongly in the Amarna period, and it continues into the post-Amarna period. So you see these transformations of language, and you have this, hints and quite strong late Egyptian features coming into the way people are articulating themselves in these texts. And there are some themes, the theme of being a humble person, being a lowly person who is suddenly elevated due to royal or divine benevolence. That's very strong in the Amarna period, and still is a kind of key theme in the post-Amarna period. It just shifts to divine intervention in your life rather than necessarily royal intervention. But there are still themes that you can kind of track through.
Okay. So
sorry, that was a very long answer. Sorry.
No, it's good.
See, I knew I'd babble.
Well, if it helps, when I spoke to Campbell Price, we planned to talk for 1 hour and we spoke for two.
Yeah. Well, I also thought that half an hour is just like, oh, it's going to be hard to control me to half an hour, but we'll try. We'll try.
As you can see so far, Elizabeth Froude is one of the most enthusiastic and personable Egyptologists around. If you are looking to dabble in some advanced historical writing, I cannot recommend any better than her 2007 book, Biographical Texts from Ramesid Egypt. This book gives a wonderful look at the lives of non-royal people, their careers, personalities, and their hopes for the afterlife. It's an excellent work, which I'll be using to the fullest extent when I reach the appropriate historical period. If you would like to read it now, though, it's available in paperback for a damn good price. Link in the episode description. I highly recommend it. There's another 16 minutes of enthusiastic discussion ahead, but first we have to do that obligatory advertising break thing. Otherwise, the automated ad will interrupt the conversation, and nobody wants that. So, we'll be back with Dr. Elizabeth Froude right after the break. See you in a moment.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And now, back to a conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Froude, talking about ancient non-royal people. How did they describe themselves? How did they depict themselves? And how does this show up in their art? Well, Liz is going to tell us.
Now, recently, you've been investigating the sort of other half of the self-representation question from texts, which is the three-dimensional art which non-royal persons use to convey messages about themselves. Again, how might you explain your findings on that so far to a party guest, particularly looking at things like place and setting and physical context for these statues?
Yeah, that's so my recent work has been really focused around especially late New Kingdom transformations in statue representation. So different styles of statue that get introduced, different types of inscription that are incorporated on statues, and developments in the way statues speak about themselves. So that's something I recently wrote an article about, was how statues have a voice and how that voice tells us something about how statues were conceptualized. So a lot of these statues are set up in temples, and they're set up probably in the courts on processional routes. So people who are coming through for procession or temple staff in their day-to-day sort of work would come through these routes and come past these statues. And it may be that these statues play with representation and play with voice in order to get your attention. So as people are walking past, you know, there's tons of statues on either side. Imagine a temple like Karnak, where, you know, you have many hundreds of statues being set up in different parts of the temple. And if you're wanting to get people's attention, then you need to be doing something distinctive, or you need to get, you know, have a reputation as being a particularly striking statue. And so sometimes the statue forms do that and grab your attention. So there are statues that show people begging with their hands to their mouth. And those statues speak. And they speak in the first person voice, and they say, you know, hi, I'm a statue of so-and-so and of this very important person. And if you tell me your problems or you tell me your desires, I have a direct ear to the god or the goddess, and I will intercede for you. And these statues that have their own voices are not speaking as the biological person they represent. They're kind of speaking as the statue, and the statue seems to have its own identity that is related to the person they're representing, but also separate from that. So some statues have their own titles. So they have titles like Bald One of the Goddess, and they actually have like a bald head, which is really cool. Some statues have the title Herald. Some statues have the title Watchman, or Doorkeeper. And so they have their own titles that the individual they're representing would not have held at life. These are not titles that, you know, a high priest of Amun would not have been a doorkeeper, or a high priest of Anuris would not have been a doorkeeper. But so that it's the statue's title, and it's the statue that's speaking, and it's a statue that has a distinctive presence and a distinctive self within these spaces. And actually, the doorkeepers are some of my favorite statues, because they're little wee statues about roughly 30 centimeters high. And they have some of them have a little protrusion at the back. So you have a little statue of a man kind of seated with his knees tucked up and his hands crossed upon his knees. So just a little simple, what we would call block statue type. And yet there's a little protrusion at the back where you can imagine it being tucked under a temple door to keep the temple door open or closed as a kind of locking mechanism. And they say that they do that, that they're kind of guarding, you know, here I am, I'm Min Moser, the doorkeeper, and I will stand by your doors and protect your doors. And they actually speak to the god and kind of state that they have this role. And Min Moser, who is a high priest of Anuris, would never in a million years have been a little gifier sitting by the door keeping guard. But his statue was. So it extends and diversifies your kind of human sphere of influence during your life is extended and diversified through your statue presentation, which, you know, extends beyond your life into your afterlife. So all of these potentials that statues have really fascinate me. And I'm just starting to explore this some more with some different types of statues beyond what I've talked about in that particular article. So that's been really fun.
Wow. I can imagine better afterlives than being a doorstop.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Well, actually, I don't know. Because they're quite small, and if they're in the sanctuary space, then, you know, if they're holding open the doors of the god's kind of shrine in the sanctuary, which some of them seem to imply that they're doing, then, you know, you're pretty close to the god statue. That puts you in a good position.
Out of curiosity, would a person like Menmos have multiple statues with different roles?
Yeah, he's actually really interesting. So Menmos is he's high priest of Anuris during the reign of Ramses II. And he seems to be, well, high priests of Anuris are very associated with the site of Abydos, and they seem to be based there. They seem to be working there. The temples that they're connected with are quite close by to Abydos. So a lot of his material comes from Abydos. And he has a number of really, really interesting statues. But one that I'm working on right now is an unpublished statue in the museum and the Egyptian Museum in Berlin. And it shows him grinding grain or incense, actually. So he's standing bent over a grinding kern with his hands on the handstone, like he's about to push, you know, grind the substance that he's grinding forward. And you can see a little squares on the statue that maybe represent grain or incense. And he says on the inscription on the statue says, you know, I am the Shabti of Menmos. I am the Shabti before the god, before Osiris. So the statue refers to itself as a Shabti. So it's a kind of servant statue. And yet on the front of the statue, it says that he is grinding incense and incense for the gods and grinding offerings for the gods. So he is someone who is presenting himself as quite a lowly person. I mean, Menmos again in his life would not have been grinding. He would not have been, he was way too important for that. So it's a role play showing his service to the gods by showing him grinding incense. And he's using a statue type that was quite prominent in the late 18th dynasty. So he's reviving a statue type. But the statues in the late 18th dynasty were much smaller, probably mostly from tomb contexts. And again, they're high elite individuals, grinding grain, sometimes incense for the gods, but they're tiny wee little statues. So he takes that, he triples the size of it. So his statue is about 2 to 3 times the size of any of these earlier examples. So of course, in the Ramessid period, you have to be bigger and better. And so he makes himself bigger and better. And it's made out of red granite, which may be the size of it and the material, the investment in red granite, amongst other things, other kind of mentions of temple environments in the texts themselves, make me think that it's possible that statue was set up in a temple. We don't have a provenance for it. It doesn't have an archaeological provenance, but all the clues point to it perhaps being a temple statue. So you have this well-known individual who has lots of other sort of more conventional statues showing himself grinding incense or preparing incense for the gods as a kind of divine, as a servant for the gods. And so it's a travesty and a role play, and it shows the the kind of potentials of three-dimensional representation to be quite, to say different things about the capacity of the self, I guess. And I find the potentials of that very curious, and I'm just starting to really explore the implications of this statue for his broader self-presentation.
Sounds fascinating. We'll have to get you back to discuss Minmos when we reach the appropriate time.
I'd love to talk about him some more. There's an amazing object of his in the Ashmolean Museum, which is really strange. So I'd happily give you some more details about that sometime.
Okay, definitely. So how did you first become interested in ancient Egypt, and what convinced you that this was the path you wanted to pursue for your work?
Well, I mean, I'm from New Zealand. I'm a New Zealander, so very far, grew up very, very far from Egypt, and very far from any experience of Egyptian culture. So, you know, Egyptology has quite a prominent position in Britain, and, you know, kids at school in Britain do ancient Egypt as a primary school topic, and that's not the case in New Zealand. So I think what happened was, when I was quite young, about 8 or 9, my parents took me traveling to Europe, and we went to Greece, and we went to Israel, and I saw ancient, you know, archaeological sites in these places. And I suddenly got very interested in ancient civilizations and archaeology. And that sparked the interest. But then, of course, you know, as a teenager or whatever, I wanted to do all sorts of different things. But I sort of began to explore, just through reading and other things, different ancient cultures. And I had a friend of my father who had Gardner's Grammar on his bookshelf. Quite randomly, I think, because he was a historian, he was interested in the ancient world, and he had this copy of Alan Gardner's Egyptian Grammar, which is, you know, hardbound, beautifully produced book, full of hieroglyphs, full of this strange world. And I remember him showing me this book, this beautiful book. I remember opening it and thinking, wow, I've never seen anything like this before. I would love to be able to read this language. And so I got in touch with Professor Spallinger, Tony Spallinger at Auckland University, when I was in my late teens, just about to start university, and he gave me some advice about subjects that I should do at school to prepare myself. And then I, at university, I started to do Egyptian language and some Egyptian history, and that was that. I was hooked and lucky enough to be able to pursue it. So I never intended to become an Egyptologist. I just thought, I'll do this for as long as possible, really enjoy it, learn as much as I can, and then get a proper job. And that didn't happen. Lucky me.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
So it's often said that detectives tend to have one unsolved case that they never quite cracked. This is something I ask every person who comes on the show, but if you could definitively answer one question or problem from the ancient world, what would it be?
Wow. There are so many things we don't know. So, I mean, that, you know, and of course, that it's that such this the kind of cliche that the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. There are so many problems and things that we don't know. And it's hard for me to even begin to know where or how to answer that question. But I guess right now, something that's close to my heart is, because it's Disability History Month here, it's just started in Britain, and there's lots of activity around that. And of course, I became physically disabled about 4 years ago. So I'm very interested in the representations of disability and how disability was conceptualized. Mm. And that's a problem for the ancient Egyptian context that I would love to know more about, is the experience of disability, how disability was understood, whether if you were physically disabled, you could still be a priest, or priestess in a temple, whether you could, you know, how this might have affected elite and non-elite lived experience. And so that would be something, that would be a problem in the material that I think I would love to have an answer to. I mean, but the answer is going to be vast and complex and involve multiple sources. But yeah, I'd be, right now I'm very curious about that. And I don't want to be, you know, the disabled scholar who does disability, because that's what disabled scholars do.
Sure.
But it's not well studied for ancient Egypt. And it is an area where I feel like I need to see people like me. And so that's my, maybe down the line, 10 years from now, whenever, that's going to be something that I want to come back to and do some more work on, and maybe try and solve that detective, or begin that detective story.
That sounds really interesting. And maybe in 10 years, when I finally reach the 19th dynasty or something, I will have you back to talk about that.
Awesome. I'd love that.
Yep. So that brings me to the end of my questions for this interview. Thank you very much, Liz, for joining the show and telling us all about your investigations so far.
Thank you very much for letting me babble.
My thanks to Dr. Froude for joining me for such an enjoyable discussion. If you're interested in learning more about her work, I've put some links in the episode description regarding her research and her life. I know most people sleep on episode descriptions, but this one is worth your time. Liz's story and her experiences are inspiring for reasons both academic and personal. We didn't touch on it in the interview, but there is more to this Egyptologist than libraries, laboratories, and hieroglyphs. If you're in the mood to expand your understandings, Liz's story will hit you for six.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.